It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Today, bored to death.
If we don't do anything about it, then we're doomed to bore ourselves to death through planetary warlike behavior, which we blow ourselves up, basically, out of a sense of, oh, this is interesting, this is entertaining. That's where I think we're going.
I'm bored. I'm the chairman of the...
Another form of boredom is what one could perhaps call repetitive boredom, in which something that's really nice in itself gets boring due to a sheer amount of repetition.
Boredom is most often people who have a sense that there's nothing to do.
Is there nothing better to do than doing nothing? Generations of layabouts, loafers, and slackers have made doing nothing sound like a dream job. Maybe they actually like being bored? In this hour, we'll think long and hard about boredom, including the philosophy of boredom. Trust me, it's more interesting than you'd think. But first, Albert Nirenberg. He's a Canadian filmmaker who produces documentaries about ordinary things hiding in plain sight. Things we take for granted, like stupidity and laughter. He's made films about both, as well as founding the World Stupidity Awards and Laughter Parties. Doug Gordon got a taste of his latest obsession, boredom.
We really don't know what boredom is, but maybe we should.
The film tries to challenge the conventional view of what boredom is, and the conventional view is that it's a trivial nuisance. Nobody really likes it, but it's not harmful. That's not true. Basically, you know, a bunch of scientists were doing MRI scans of people's brains, and I guess they created situations that bored them. And they noticed that, contrary to what you might expect, you'd think that when bored people, when you look at them, they look sleepy. You think, oh, they're slowing down. The people that scanned these people's brains were shocked to discover that quite the opposite was taking place. Their brains were actually speeding up the moment they became bored. That was the first sort of weird thing. The second thing was a study at the University of Waterloo did very elaborate tests based on people watching a movie with people putting up laundry. And they came to a fairly shocking result that at this sort of pivotal moment, as people tune out and get bored, their cortisol levels jump, which is the stress hormone, and their heartbeat accelerates. The heartbeat acceleration is minor, but it's probably interesting. But it's the cortisol jump, which is intriguing, and that absolutely makes sense. What it's basically saying is that boredom is not a trivial, annoying, superficial state. It's actually a hidden state of stress.
Wow.
Over time, it may be a hidden state of major stress. There's some evidence that being bored chronically will increase your risk of dying younger.
So we can actually die of boredom. There's that old expression of is bored to death. That can actually, in some cases, be true?
According to a British study, absolutely true. The only thing, it's one of these mass studies where they took thousands of people, and then they did the data afterwards, I think after some of the people may have been dead. So basically, it was a study of civil servants, a statistical study where one of the questions happened to be, are you bored in your life? And if the people answered yes to that question, they then looked at their mortality rate, and they discovered that there was a shocking difference in the mortality rate for people who reported that they were bored and people who didn't. It doesn't stand up to, let's say, the kind of science you might want in this situation where you would go and revisit these people and find out if that really was the factor.
Mm-hmm.
But generally speaking, a study of thousands of British civil servants suggested that people who reported that they were bored died earlier than people who didn't.
Did you experience stress when you were bored?
Absolutely.
Not only was I bored, but I was stressed. And I was stressed about being bored. which was even more stressful because boredom is a kind of stress, which altogether was super stressful.
I think it's also damaging to integrity. That's one of the things that is interesting about boredom. It's sort of soul-destroying because if you kind of have a plan about what you want to do and what you want to be and what you want to react to in that environment, if you start getting bored, kind of everything goes out the window. And that's something that we know very well in addiction research, because one of the key factors in relapse with people that have addictions is boredom.
Boredom, I think, is my number one enemy. I need to find out something to keep me from getting bored, because if I get bored, I feel like I'm going to have to use something. 90% of the people here have all agree that boredom, what are they going to do when they go home and they're bored? Because then your brain starts thinking, hey, you know, when I was bored before, I went and snorted a pill, or I went and smoked some crystal meth, went to a bar and got drunk. So I think a lot of the people here, whether they like to admit it or not, boredom is one of the number one keys.
You make the case in your film that compulsory education starting in grade school is actually an unintentional boring machine, a place that manufactures boredom. Can you talk a bit about that?
I guess the debate is it on purpose? Is it by accident? What the film says, which I think is fresh, is that what is tragic in our system is that people quickly assume that the problem is the teaching. It's the subject material. It is the things that are taught. And the twist in the film is that I believe that as long as you have a sedentary culture, meaning everyone's just sitting around, then you get boredom. In fact, it doesn't matter if you have possibly the most interesting class or subject or curriculum, that if everyone is sitting and sedentary all day long, you get boredom. That's just the way it is.
In the film, you talk about what new science has discovered about sedentary culture in terms of the damages it can cause, the illnesses. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, other people are saying this, but when you add it up, it is shocking. I think the Mayo Institute put it all together, but basically they're tying chronic sedentary behavior to 35 chronic illnesses, including heart disease, diabetes, obesity, obviously, depression. It's all tied to the obsession with sedentary behavior, which actually, this is the key thing, starts in school. It's true that computers do it to us. It's true that television does it to us. But it is the school system which essentially trains kids to be sedentary. I can say categorically, without exaggeration, that probably the number one health threat to children is the education system. It's the system that trains people to be sedentary blobs. There's new research that shows even when you compensate, this is the scary part. Let's say you're sedentary for 8 hours a day because you're at school or at work. You compensate by going to the gym and working out. Apparently, it doesn't undo the damage that you did by sitting around. It's scary stuff.
Yeah. There's something else interesting. Sandy Mann, professor of psychology at the University of Central Lancashire, makes an interesting point.
We're more bored than ever before, and this is the kind of the paradox. We have more things to entertain us than ever before.
Her claim, and I agree, is that we're living in a time right now where Apple computer would tell us that they have helped destroy boredom, because now next time you're in a bank lineup or any kind of lineup, you can whip out your iPhone and you can get on Facebook and text people, you know, or look up some information, whatever you might do. And I actually think that's true and that is good. I think it's good that you can do that. What is scary is that screens, computer screens, again, the neurosciences in this case is what makes things intriguing, because you kind of have this feeling, but you can't really understand it until you look a little deeper at the science. What they discovered, and I found this is amazing, is that screens by their very nature, and I'm talking about iPhone screens, computer screens, iPad screens, that kind of thing, and even movie screens or the outdoor screens you see in Times Square, those screens, because of their flashing bright nature, they actually hack into the part of our brain that looks for fascinating things, like, for example, water sources. Water in the distance flickers, and it may explain why we are fascinated by diamonds. Diamonds look like flickering water. And to a certain extent, that's what screens do too. They kind of flicker. They also, in a sense, create a sense of novelty. Because we know that the screen has the ability to change and morph into other things, when we look at a screen, we think there's always something new going on. So it doesn't matter that you might be looking at the same old Facebook page or the same old website, but your brain is fooled into thinking something new is always happening on the screen. And that's why people can sit sometimes at a computer and 6 hours will go by and they will not realize that all that time went by and they really weren't doing anything. The conclusion of this film, Boredom, is that is America today. America today is a guy or a woman sitting in front of a computer feeling like he's had a vast range of new, intriguing, novel experiences as he whips through the internet. Pull back, and what you really see is a guy who's probably slightly obese sitting in his underpants. That's America. By the way, I'm not in my underpants right now.
Okay, good. Plus, you're not American. I'm Canadian as well, so, and I'm here down in America, but I am not in my underpants. I'm quite well-dressed, I must say, especially for radio.
By the way, I don't mean to pick on America. I would say it's Canada, too. It's everywhere in the industrialized world. It's just that America's emblematic of everything, so we might as well make it emblematic of this phenomenon, too.
Yeah, that makes sense. Have you discovered a cure for boredom?
Basically, they found out that you shouldn't do anything for longer than 90 minutes. So if you're sitting at a computer and you realize you've been there like 2 hours, it's time to get up and do something else. After 90 minutes, you actually are far less effective. You're generally not enjoying yourself, and you're not really actually getting the job done. So it's a good idea to go outside, have a walk, maybe do some exercise, jump around.
Get out of that chair, the sedentary culture.
Stand up, you!
Yeah.
We're talking to you. One of the side effects of our screen sedentary culture is we mistakenly think that real experience is kind of boring, but it really is not. You never get tired of a nice walk in a nice park.
Still, you shouldn't do that for 90 minutes either, right?
That's right. In terms of class time, they're finding out that the average attention span is only best for about 22 minutes. But that kind of makes sense. Classes should maybe be 22 minutes long. You would not get bored, mostly, if you were able to stand up once in a while and your classes were 22 minutes long.
Sure. Be easier to focus. Do you think that we can ever eliminate boredom in our lifetime, or are we stuck with it?
No, we actually don't want to eliminate boredom because there's a whole other side. There's a very positive side to boredom. Philosophical boredom, I might argue, is kind of harmless, meaning the feeling that you should do something with your life or with your existence is not a bad thing. Chronic industrial boredom that you might experience working at a boring job or sitting in a classroom with a dreary teacher, that's something else. That, I think, should be questioned and in some cases should be made illegal. I think there's some teachers and professors that should be jailed for bore crimes.
bore crime tribunals. Yeah, there's a whole industry here.
If anybody wants to set up a bore crime tribunal, I'm there.
Yeah, absolutely. They got to pay you royalties.
That's right.
Albert Nirenberg is the director of the documentary Boredom. He spoke with Doug Gordon. Coming up, we'll explore the philosophy of boredom and the fine art of doing nothing. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. From children to famous philosophers, everyone complains about being bored. Maybe we should try thinking about it instead. Lars Svensson is a philosopher at the University of Bergen in Norway and author of A Philosophy of Boredom. He says the feeling has a long, long history.
I think that some varieties of boredom have been around as long as there has been men on this earth. If you, for instance, read the Ecclesiastes, it starts with everything is emptiness, or vanity, depending on the translation. Then you can read Seneca, the Roman philosopher, writes about the tedium vita, I mean, the tiredness of life. But a striking thing is that up until about the late 18th century, boredom seemed to be a pretty marginal phenomenon reserved for priests, nobility, and so on. And what happened was that boredom was democratized. Suddenly it became available to all of us. And that's around the same time that boredom also stopped being a status symbol. I mean, before that, one could actually brag about being bored. But as boredom became available to the masses as well, it was no longer much to brag about.
So when did this happen? When was the word boredom actually coined?
The English word boredom is found at the earliest in the 1760s. The German Langeweile is from approximately the same time. Actually, the Norwegian kjedsomhet is a little bit earlier, so maybe we started getting really bored a little bit earlier. It's very striking that all these words for boredom in different languages pop up at approximately the same time. There's definitely been some sort of major cultural shift around that
time. What was happening then?
There are lots of economic changes. You get a middle class starts to develop. Religion no longer has as much of a grip on people. And of course, religion is a tremendously important source of meaning.
Wasn't this also about the time that the very, very first beginnings of the Industrial Revolution were coming about? The invention of the steam engine, the spinning jenny. Does that have something to do with our discovery of boredom or the spread of boredom?
I think so. Of course, if I should go a little bit Marxist here, I mean, one could use a word such as alienation, people becoming alienated from work and so on. But I actually think that the emergence of individualism is much more important, because what happens then is that all these former collective sources of meaning, I mean, they get diminished in importance, and then each one of us has to find some sort of meaning for ourselves, and that's pretty tricky.
You know, I realize we've been talking about boredom and assuming that we mean the same thing, but in fact, boredom can mean really many different things, can't it? And there must be different types of boredom.
Yeah, sure. There are varieties of boredom. One pretty obvious form of boredom is what I call situative boredom, where something specific in a situation or the lack of something specific in a situation is boring. For instance, if one listens to a dreadfully boring, long-winded lecture, I mean, that can be hell on earth. Another form of boredom is what one could perhaps call repetitive boredom, in which something that's really nice in itself gets boring due to the sheer amount of repetition. For instance, eating at, say, Gordon Ramsay's restaurant for a night, I mean, that's wonderful. Eating there 365 days a year would be dreadful. And then there's the deep existential boredom where the soul is empty, the world is empty. That's a variety of boredom that's very closely related to depression. And then there's creative boredom, which is not characterized so much by its contents as by the fact that it actually forces you to do something. I guess one could describe my book on boredom as a result of creative boredom.
So how would you describe the feeling of boredom? I mean, we all talk about it, we all think we know what it is, and yet, what is it?
One could perhaps describe it metaphorically as if eternity has entered this world. I mean, you're stuck in a now, an instant that's empty and seems to have absolutely no end whatsoever. Often one can hear that, well, if you're bored, you haven't got enough to do. I think that's plain wrong. I mean, you can have so much to do, you can work like insane and still be so bored with what you're doing because you simply find no personal meaning in it.
Do you think it's our own fault when we're bored? I mean, do you think, is boredom a choice?
Emotions generally seem to be something that happens to us, not something we choose. On the other hand, we are responsible for what sort of situations we place ourselves in. And in that sense, one is also responsible for one's own boredom. The next responsibility is, well, how am I going to relate to this boredom? That's definitely my responsibility. And I think that the worst approach is to make one's entire life a constant flight away from boredom. Because that means letting boredom dictate, in effect, one's entire life. I think that a much better approach is actually to see boredom as some sort of voice of conscience, as an emotion that tells you something about the way you live your life. And if you, in boredom, feel that your life has become almost nothing, maybe that's because you live your life in such a way as a nothing. And maybe that's a wake-up call to take a different approach to what you do in life. And in that sense, I think that Nietzsche is absolutely correct when he says that whoever shields himself completely off from boredom also shields himself completely off from himself. I think boredom is actually a source of knowledge of oneself and one's life.
So if a great deal of our current Western culture involves a flight from boredom with, you know, a constant ramping up of stimulation and novelty in an attempt to escape the feeling of being bored, what would life be like if we turned around instead and embraced boredom? What would that look like? What would we do?
I think that rather than embrace boredom, I'd say that one should accept boredom. Accept the fact that boredom is a factor in one's life, but it's only one factor among many. By taking that sort of approach, boredom no longer becomes this big, scary thing that one has to spend one's entire life fleeing away from.
So in some ways, we simply need to learn to become more resilient.
Yeah, I think so. And I also think that probably one of the worst things one can do when bringing up children is to keep them stimulated at all times. Because I think that if you're going to have a fairly livable life, you have to be able to learn yourself to live with boredom. I'm trying to learn it myself, but I have extremely low thresholds for boredom.
Lars Svensson is a philosopher at the University of Bergen in Norway and author of A Philosophy of Boredom. There's something paradoxical about boredom. It's kind of like you really don't want to do anything, but you can't stand doing nothing. Maybe the problem is that we're not good at being bored. Maybe it's a skill. Tom Lutz is the author of Doing Nothing, A History of Loafers, Loungers, Slackers, and Bums in America. He tells Steve Paulson why he decided to do something about doing nothing.
It began when my son, Cody, at the age of 18, moved into my house from the East Coast, where he was living with his mother, and proceeded to lie on the couch kind of day in and day out doing nothing, hence the title Doing Nothing. And I was amazed at how angry it made me to see him lying there, even though I had spent an enormous amount of time doing nothing when I was exactly his age. So I really should have been able to understand that he was at a particular stage of life. And it literally made me angry. My body would flood with hormones and emotion. And I had not been an angry parent. I didn't want to be an angry parent. I had one of those, and I didn't want to repeat that mistake. And I really started looking into the subject of doing nothing in order to understand my own odd emotional reaction to seeing him laying around watching TV, which obviously I'd seen him doing at various times for 18 years already.
So instead of blowing up at him, you went off and wrote a book.
Yeah, I would go back downstairs to my study and kind of cool down, come back up and say, well, how's the resume coming along? His resume, of course, at that point was, I went to high school. There wasn't much more to add to it. And he would say, I'm working on it.
Now, there's a difference, though, between sitting on the couch watching TV day after day and traveling around the country, knocking around, you know, working as a short order cook, getting some manual labor jobs. I mean, that it may seem like doing nothing, but actually those are all life experiences. And really doing nothing, I mean, being a couch potato, I can see why that would get to you.
Yeah. Now, of course, I have this somewhat romanticized version of my own past that I can tell, in which I do a lot of, you know, I guess interesting things. I hop the freight trains and I travel around Europe and I do all sorts of things. But I also spend an enormous amount of time just, you know, smoking pot and laying in a hammock and doing absolutely nothing. So there are two different ways to see my own story. Certainly my own father thought I was doing a whole lot of nothing.
Hmm. Now, is doing nothing the same as being bored?
No, and actually, you know, I am an expert at doing nothing, as I said, but I'm not really an expert on boredom. I studied people who claimed that doing nothing was the highest form of human activity, an ideal. And boredom, on the other hand, is most often people who have a sense that there's nothing to do, that there's nothing worth doing or nothing, certainly nothing to do at the moment. So on the one hand, you've got people who are bored because they're doing nothing and they don't like the fact that they're doing nothing. On the other hand, you have people who are doing nothing and they are proud of the fact that they're doing nothing. And those are the real classic slackers in Western history.
Now, why would some people say that doing nothing is the highest thing, the sort of the greatest goal in life?
Well, it's a rejection of the fundamental cultural values, most significantly the values placed on work. And it's often, of course, people who don't think that the work that they're being offered is worth doing. And so to do nothing is a form of resistance to wage slavery or boring, horrible jobs.
So basically the idea there is that to work, you're buying into the system and it's in essence the opposite of pleasure, the opposite of enjoying life.
Well, some people argue that you have to do nothing in order to enjoy life. I mean, either whether it's a kind of Zen version of it, a contemplative life version of it, or people who think that even our standard entertainments, you know, watching TV, watching Fagoni films, these things are ridiculous as well, and we don't want to do those. We want out of all of the current state of things.
Now, there's a long history of people who have written about doing nothing. And one of the ironies, of course, is that those people who often exalt doing nothing have been very busy getting the word out. I mean, often they're out writing books advocating the joys of doing nothing. But anyway, Herman Melville wrote a famous story, Bartleby the Scrivener, which to some degree touches on this subject, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Bartleby is working significantly on Wall Street. This is an 1853 story, 1851, 1853. And he starts off being a fairly good worker for a lawyer. He's a copier. He's basically a human Xerox machine. But then he just stops working, and his boss asks him to do something. He says, I'd prefer not to.
Bartleby, come in here and verify this notice of petition to administer an estate.
I'd prefer not to.
Bartleby, come in here and verify this notice of petition to administer an estate.
I would prefer not to.
Prefer not to? What do you mean, prefer not to? Here, take it and verify the notice.
I'd prefer not to.
Public records?
But it's part of your job. Are you refusing to do your job?
Excuse me, sir. Mr. Waxman.
It remains a mystery in the story. It's one of the great stories in American literary history, and partly because it's very, very hard to say exactly what it's about. But he stops working, and it's confusing to everyone around him, especially his boss, who just doesn't know quite how to deal with him. It's not outright rebellion. He never says, I refuse to. He says, I'd prefer not to. So it's an odd kind of passive resistance to the state of things.
So why does he stop doing his work?
Well, he eventually is such a slacker, Bartleby, that he stops eating as well, even though his boss, after he's thrown in debtor's prison and into the tombs, his boss tries to get him things to eat, and he simply refuses to. He prefers not to eat and eventually dies from doing nothing. So from the perspective of Melville, perhaps this is a story of what happens when you drop out completely, a warning tale. But the boss, the lawyer who hires him, is a very kind of small-minded. He's brought to a certain kind of empathy by Bartleby, partly because he can't understand him. But the boss is certainly not who we want to be. As we read the story, we're more on Bartleby's side than we are on the boss's. But we can't be on either side, really.
And yet this is not exact. You wouldn't think this would be a prescription to be one of the great literary stories in American cultural history. I mean, it would seem to be the kind of this dead-end life of Bartleby. What gives it such legs?
We are a culture that's obsessed with work. Europeans make fun of us for always asking the first thing when we meet somebody, so what's your name, number one, number two, what do you do? And Europeans find this, depending on their class, either ridiculous or déclassé. Tocqueville noticed it immediately in the 1830s. We're a culture that has a very strong work ethic. When Max Weber writes about the Protestant work ethic, you know, he finds the prime example of it in Benjamin Franklin. We're a country obsessed with work and therefore obsessed with not working at the same time. So Office Space, one of the great slacker movies, is about living in cubicles and entering reports into your computer all day long.
Corporate accounts payable. Nina speaking.
Hello, Peter. What's happening?
We have sort of a problem here. Yeah, you apparently didn't put one of the new cover sheets on your TPS reports.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry about that. I forgot.
Yeah. You see, we're putting the cover sheets on all TPS reports now before they go out. Did you see the memo about this?
Yeah. Yeah, I have the memo right here. I just forgot. But it's not shipping out till tomorrow, so there's no problem.
Yeah. If you could just go ahead and make sure you do that from now on, that would be great. And I'll go ahead and make sure you get another copy of that memo. Okay?
Yeah, no, I have the memo. I've got it. It's right.
Hello, Phil. What's happening?
Now, of course, if we ever had a perfect slacker or a perfect loafer or a perfect lounger, we don't know who they are, right? They're lost to history because they don't leave a trace. They really do nothing. If you really do nothing, nobody knows who you are. So the people we know, the people who have left a trace, have left a trace because they did some kind of work that made people sit up and take notice. So we have a select group of people who were doing nothing who are the famous slackers. And there are also, you know, these images like Charlie Chaplin's Little Tramp, who are, you know, just fictional characters. People love to consume images of slackers. We love Peter in Office Space.
Looks like you've been missing a lot of work lately.
I wouldn't say I've been missing it, Bob.
Good one.
Oh, that's terrific, Peter.
Because we love these characters, people's authors sometimes represent themselves as that character, like Kerouac. Represent himself as a guy that's just wandering around the country doing nothing. But in fact, he was a very hardworking novelist. There's a kind of market value to representing yourself as a slacker. Now, in Office Space, Peter and his coworkers are kind of bored, and that's what kind of pushes him out of that work world. It's the boredom of his job is the problem, and figuring out, you know, kind of this blissful doing nothing that he's into in the middle of the film is his alternative to that boredom.
Is there anything to be said for boredom? Like, can that be a virtue?
Oh, yeah. I mean, boredom is exactly, like I say, boredom is what gets Peter out of his job finally, right? Boredom can be a great motivator. The person who's on the couch and has a fully developed slacker philosophy and says, I am doing nothing for the good of the planet. I'm going to leave as small a footprint as I can, and that means I'm not even going to move and burn up calories. You know, that kind of theory of why it's best to do nothing doesn't move anybody forward. But after being on the couch for a number of years, one might get bored enough to actually do something.
Tom Lutz is the author of Doing Nothing, a history of loafers, loungers, slackers, and bums in America. He talked with Steve Paulson. And that's it for our conversation about boredom. But coming up, the protests in Ferguson, Missouri are on our minds. And this week's bookmark. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now, book. Bookmarks, writers on books they love.
I'm John Waters, the author of the new book, Car Sick, and I would recommend a book to you called The Complete Short Stories of James Purdy. I wrote the introduction. James Purdy is certainly not for everybody. His books are like a box of poison chocolates where you can eat one every night before you go to sleep. His characters are so lonely that sometimes they just go in phone booths and call weather so people think they have friends. It's about women that sometimes hear gossip on the wind from other people talking evilly about them. They're very gothic. They're very melodramatic. No one ever liked them very much. They were never successful that much, his books. But I think he is really an undiscovered genius that few people really, really like. But I would say his books are really a new kind of evil, a new kind of weirdness that makes everybody uncomfortable. Every one of his stories will make you kind of squirm in the best possible way. I'm a big fan of James Purdy. I knew him a little bit, and he unfortunately died, but he lived a long, long time. And even his obituary in the New York Times was controversial, saying how he bit the hand of everybody that tried to help him and everything. So he was an odd duck, something that I've always loved. But I think if you have patience, he's not an easy read, and I don't think books should be easy. I think they should be hard and challenge you. So I would get this book. It's really long. It's 500 pages. But you can just take that book and read it for the rest of your life. Read one story a week, or one story a month, or one story a year, and you always have that little perverse dosage of James Purdy. The first time I read James Purdy was probably a book called Malcolm, which was the only book he had that was a hit, that was later turned into a play that ran about three performances on Broadway, directed by Edward Albee. It starred in it Shirley Stoller, who was amazing. She was in The Honeymoon Killers, Carol Baker's daughter. I saw it, actually. I went to see it, and it was kind of great. But I liked his books like Jeremy's Version and The House of the Solitary Maggot. Now, that's a good title. That's a good title. But they were very obscure movies, and some of them were very sexual and very violent and very crazy and politically incorrect, gaily incorrect all the time. His audience was rare but dedicated.
John Waters recommends The Complete Short Stories of James Purdy. And you can find more bookmarks and an interview with Waters on our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. With massive protests in Ferguson, Missouri this week over the shooting of unarmed teenager Michael Brown, we've been thinking about how prevalent that toxic combination of racial conflict and police violence is in America. A young sociologist named Alice Goffman has just written a remarkable and somewhat controversial book on the subject. It's called On the Run, and it's based on her long-term ethnographic study of young black men in Philadelphia. Now, Goffman is white, and when she began her research, she was a student at the University of Pennsylvania. She moved off campus and into a poor black neighborhood downtown where she lived for the next 6 years, commuting between the Ivy League and the inner city. Steve Paulson recently sat down with Goffman to talk about how constant police surveillance has shaped the lives of the young men who became some of her closest friends.
So tell me about some of these guys you met and got to know very well, Mike and Chuck. What kind of lives did they lead?
So Chuck, I met him when he was 18. He's Mike's really good friend, and they grew up together in this neighborhood that I call Sixth Street. And I met him when he was sitting in county jail on trial for an aggravated assault charge. And I met him by starting to go with Mike to visit him in county jail. He had made it all the way through high school without any jail time, which he was super proud of. He had made it to 18, and in his senior year of high school, he got into a fight in the schoolyard with a kid who had called his mom a crack whore, and he pushed the kid's face into the snow, and then the school cops charged him with aggravated assault. So he had this aggravated assault charge, and since he was 18, he was in the adult system. So he was pulled out of school and had this pending trial going for 8 months of his senior year while he sat in county jail, and he couldn't make the bail because he couldn't afford it. So at the end of that, almost all the charges were dismissed. He just had to pay like a couple hundred dollars in court fees. So then He spent the summer at home, didn't get into any trouble, tried to re-enroll again as a senior the next year, and the secretary told him that he couldn't enroll because he was 19 and that was too old. So, like, then he was a high school dropout. And then he couldn't pay the court fees that came due after his case ended. So then he had a bench warrant out for the court fees. So then he was a fugitive. And that's, like, the kind of point of the book. It's, like, it's not just that the United States is now massively imprisoning African-American young men and returning them home with felony convictions. It's that there's this whole underside of the criminal justice system that's much less visible, that's about surveillance and policing, and that is creating a kind of fugitive life, not just for guys with warrants, but for people on probation or parole, young men living in neighborhoods like this who are worried that any moment they will be seized.
So it sounds like you're saying that there can be what would seem to be fairly minor incidents that totally change someone's life, and basically that change their lives in a direction that then becomes trafficking outside the legal system.
Yeah, so Tim's first arrest, Tim is Chuck's youngest brother. There's three brothers, Chuck, Reggie, and Tim. And Tim's first arrest came when he was 11. His older brother, Chuck, was driving him to school in his girlfriend's car, and the cops stopped them, ran the tags, and the car came up as stolen in California. So they charged Chuck with receiving stolen property, and they charged his younger brother, Tim, age 11, with accessory to receiving stolen property. So then he was placed on probation, which then he violated later for another very small thing. So that's what set him down the path. Mike, Chuck's very good friend, his first arrest came at 13 when he was stopped and searched and found in possession of a very small amount of marijuana. You know, at the same time that I was living in this neighborhood and writing notes every day about what the police were doing and the level of surveillance and arresting, I was also, like, commuting to Penn and then Princeton for class. So then I got to watch this whole other group of men who were also young men and also getting into different things, like,
and you probably
or,
saw a lot of the kids at the University of Penn smoking pot too, and
yeah,
they
not
probably
just pot,
never faced
like
any
much harder drugs like at frat parties. Yeah, so it was amazing to me to see the contrast, like, not very many blocks away. Here are all these mostly white students, elite students on college campuses, and there's drugs and there's drunk driving and there's fights and there's rape, and these kids are graduating with degrees in English and business and sociology and not felony convictions. The kind of racial politics of this country are fraught. And the thing is like, it's not because there's a level of crime that is like over and above what's happening in lots of other neighborhoods. It's really about changes in policing and imprisonment. So beginning in the late 1970s, the United States started this massive social experiment in punishment. And this wasn't punishment leveled like across the population. It was really targeted at Black and also Latino communities. So the level of policing in Mike and Chuck's neighborhood was a different world from anything I had seen in the white neighborhood that I had grown up in or on Penn's campus.
One of the things you write about is how a lot of these guys, even if they got really hurt, I mean, pistol whipped, even shot, they would do anything to avoid going to the hospital, going to the ER, because they were worried the cops might catch them there.
Yeah. In the first few years of doing this research, I would just hang out in the ER and watch the police walk Black men in handcuffs out of the ER. It was like an amazingly great place to make their stats, to find people to arrest. You know, the police are an occupying force. Like 52 times in the first 18 months, I watched the police raid houses, chase people through houses, break down doors. I think like 14 times I watched the police punch, choke, beat, stomp on, beat with their nightsticks young men after they had chased them down and cuffed them in the street.
You had seen this personally.
Yeah. Yeah. I was taking notes every day. I was taking field notes every day. So you have to learn how to run. You have to learn when the police are coming, and you have to learn how to run from them. And you have to learn what the undercovers look like, and you have to learn who else around you may have a warrant or may have heat on them for various reasons, and then who to avoid. And it's this whole strategy of negotiating everyday life so that you can run at a moment. You have to learn where to hide.
Did you find yourself having to run?
Yes. The first time I really remember, I walked up to Chuck's house, and Chuck and Reggie were both home from prison and jail that year, and Chuck came running out of the house and said, like, the cops are coming. And I think Reggie had a warrant during that time. So Chuck took off and Reggie too, and they were like, come on, let's go. So we ran through the neighborhood, and I remember getting very out of breath, and like I was not used to running like that. And then I lost them, and then I heard them through the doorway of this woman whose house I had never been to before in the neighborhood, and she was like this very church-going, wonderfully proper woman, and they were upstairs in her boudoir. She had this amazing dressing room. Who knew? She was like a huge clothes horse. So we were up there waiting out the cops, you know.
I have to say that this takes participant observation study to extremes here. The fact that, you're on the run too.
No, because the police were totally ignoring me most of the time. Like I only got pulled in for questioning like twice in all those years. Like most of the time, like that's the thing, right? It's very race-based. So like they're not interested in white women. Like they are not interested in women as much as men, and white women, like almost not at all. So like I was almost invisible to the police a lot of the time, or like so many times I would be like outside with a group of guys and then the police would stop and search every single person, and I would just still be sitting there and the police just wouldn't bother me at all. So it's like they had a totally different way of treating white and black people. But the other thing too is like when you talk about participant observation, like if you're interested in learning about waitresses, you get a job as a waitress. So this was participant observation light because I never sold drugs. I never got arrested. I never went to prison. I never caught cases.
You've talked about how you saw a lot of things, saw violence by the police, by other people. You saw a couple of murders, didn't you?
I was once in a crowd of people and watched the police strangle someone who died. And there was talk in the family about suing the police department, and that didn't get off the ground. I was in a car when a guy who I actually didn't know, he was getting out of my car and was shot, and I didn't know if he died or not, and everybody ran, including me.
This book is getting a lot of attention now and a lot of praise. It's, among other things, just a remarkable feat of reporting. You've also gotten some criticism. And one of the lines of criticism is that because you saw so much, you became very close friends with some of these people you were hanging out with, and you witnessed a fair amount of violence. Were you ever complicit? How do you sort that out?
So the question really is like, how do you do morally responsible work with a vulnerable group of people who are in a state of legal precariousness on questions of pressing moral urgency? How do you do that work ethically? How do you report on what is happening in corners of the country that have very little voice in mainstream politics ethically and responsibly? And I think that it's not a kind of how-to manual. It's just what I did. And I think every day I was struggling with these ethical issues, and I continue to struggle with them, and I don't think I have any answers. I do think that it's important to bear witness and to do that in a way that honors the people that I got to know.
Near the end of your book, you talk about something really tragic that happened. One of the men you'd become very close to, Chuck, was killed. Can you describe what happened?
Yeah, Chuck was the peacemaker in the group. He spent a lot of time trying to mend the fences. So there'd been this dispute between the 6th Street boys and the 4th Street boys. And Chuck had been someone who was really kind of going between the groups and trying to squash the beef. He saw a guy from 4th Street outside of the Chinese store. I wasn't there, but his girlfriend was nearby and said what she thinks happened is that he saw the guy saw him, the guy kind of made a move, Chuck made a move. Chuck didn't even have a gun on him, but the guy thought he might have, and then this guy shot him in the head. So I got the call from Mike saying Chuck's been shot in the head, and I had seen Chuck like the day before, I think. So I went to get Mike from the suburbs. We went to the hospital together. When we drove in, there were like 30 guys from the neighborhood standing watch outside of the ER, like holding this vigil for Chuck. And I remember feeling really awkward as a white woman coming into the scene in downtown Philly, where it was clear like I wasn't really welcome to stand on the corner with all of his friends and neighbors and sort of stand watch, but I didn't. So I walked into the hospital and asked at the desk like what was happening, and they looked at me and then looked at the file and were like, do you actually know him? And I was like, yes, he's my cousin. So then the cops cleared everybody off the sidewalk, and at that point everybody else had gone. So then I kind of like with all my whiteness, like managed to get through the various people at the hospital and get to Chuck's room, which none of his friends were permitted to do. So, which also is like a dilemma, right? It's like, should I be here? I'm here on the basis of my whiteness. Anyway, so I'm like sitting outside of this room, and he's got tubes, and there's a TV on. It looks like he's watching it, but his face is swollen and his head is bandaged, and I don't know what's happening at that point. So I just sat there outside of the ER for many hours, and then it was like a code blue. So then all these doctors came rushing in, and the bullet like had split into his brain. So then I had to call his mom and say, actually, I think I passed the phone to the doctor, and then she told his mom, or somebody there told his mom, that he was not going to make it. And then I sat with him until his girlfriend came. His youngest brother, Tim, was pulled in for questioning because Tim had been really close by when he was killed. So Tim couldn't be there either. So we just sat there in the hospital with him, like as his body grew stiff. And so, yeah, I got to be there with him when he died.
Wow. If there's one thing that that you'd want people to take away from your book, what would it be?
So a great juvenile detention reformer, Bart Lubow, in a speech he gave a couple months ago, talked about the insatiable thirst for punishment in American society and insatiable thirst for punishing black boys and men. And I think the way the criminal justice system is currently operating, we're asking young people who are facing the most challenges in the labor market, who have the fewest resources, with the least amount of education, living in neighborhoods where violence is an everyday threat. We're asking these young people to walk the tightest possible line, to walk a line way tighter than the one any of the rest of us are asked to walk. And why are we not providing support to young people facing these challenges? Why are we offering handcuffs and jail time and this fugitive existence? We've got to turn this around.
That's Alice Goffman. She's the author of On the Run, Fugitive Life in an American City. She spoke with Steve Paulson. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Doug Gordon produced today's show with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, Raymond Tungekar, and Will Henkes. Our theme music is by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening. Be well.
PRI, Public Radio International.